The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Ross Perot.
Our guest today is in the history books as the 19% man. That was the percentage of the popular vote Ross Perot won when he ran for president in 1992. It was the largest total collected by an independent candidate in memory. Though Mr. Perot didn't win 3 years ago, he did accomplish many things. Among them, he brought the danger posed by the federal deficits to the consciousness of the American people. He probably elected Bill Clinton as president of the United States by siphoning off votes from George Bush. And he established his grassroots organization, United We Stand, as a continuing force in American politics. Hopefully, Mr. Perot today will give us his opinion of President Clinton's first 2.25 years in office, as well as the Republican Congress's first 100 days in office. We'd also like to hear his views on the U.S. trade relationship with Mexico, the future of the peso, and the outlook for the global economy, now that the North American Free Trade Agreement and the New World Treaty, both of which he opposed strenuously, have been put in place. And, of course, we'd like to know his own plans for 1996. The independent field could become quite crowded next year with Jesse Jackson, Pat Buchanan, and General Colin Powell waiting in the wings as potential third-party candidates. Before entering politics, you will recall, Mr. Perot made his name and his fortune in the world of business, borrowing $1,000 from his wife for seed money. He founded Electronic Data Systems in 1962. EDS grew into a colossus and made Mr. Perot rich by helping companies and government agencies manage their computer resources. When EDS was bought by another colossus, General Motors, Mr. Perot, after a short and stormy stint on the GM board, decided to enter the relatively placid world of national politics. While Mr. Perot's many accomplishments are most familiar to all of you, there is one that may come as a surprise. Now, if you pay close attention to this little chart I have here, you will see that, I hope you all can see this now, you will see that seasonally adjusted and corrected for inflation and the declining value of the dollar, our guest now holds the world's largest hoard of National Press Club mugs. Mr. Perot will speak on preparing for the 21st century. When he finishes, I will present him with his 7th National Press Club coffee mug. That is a record. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ross Perot.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be with you today. As we think about the recent tragedies that have occurred in our country and the problems that face our country as we prepare for the 21st century, never forget that we are the luckiest people in the world because you and I live in the greatest country in the history of man. We live in a country that literally hundreds of millions of people can only dream of coming to, but you and I are here. So never, ever forget how lucky we are. Today, as we discuss the problems that we must face and solve, please keep in mind that dealing with these problems is absolutely insignificant compared to the problems our ancestors faced as they fought and won the revolution, came from all over the world on sailing ships. Imagine what that was like. and populated this great country traveling in covered wagons. Think what that was like. They fought the Civil War and freed the slaves. They fought and won World War I and World War II, the largest wars in the history of man, and they overcame many other challenges. So the problems we have to deal with are mostly problems we've created by our own overindulgence. Very different problems. The American people will have to reassert themselves as owners of the country in order to get these problems solved. Fortunately, this is being done. Millions of ordinary, hardworking citizens own this country. And no matter how much money candidates may raise from special interests, in the final analysis, it is the vote of the ordinary citizen that determines whether or not the candidate will get elected. If every citizen would just take the time to become fully informed so that he and she cannot be manipulated by emotional one-minute television ads, then we can assure that the 21st century will be the greatest in our country's history. Look at the great country our ancestors left us. Think about their sacrifices. Look at your children and grandchildren. Shouldn't we leave them a better legacy than we received? Should we burden them with our own self-indulgence? The answers are obvious. We've been free so long we take it for granted. As we face and deal with these problems, never forget that freedom is precious, freedom is fragile. History teaches us these things. Hopefully we'll learn enough from this experience and not repeat it again later. Hopefully our children will learn and not do this again in the 21st century. But history does tend to repeat itself. Recent history teaches us that we certainly cannot count on our elected officials to solve our problems while we, the owners of the country, remain on the sidelines uninformed and uninvolved. I can summarize everything I've said so far with Thomas Jefferson's words. Here they are. Whenever the people are well informed, they can be entrusted with their own government. The people themselves are its only safe depositories. We've got to prepare for the 21st century. One of our primary goals should be to see that there are no major wars in the 21st century. We had two world wars in the 20th century. The next major war could literally destroy the planet, and we must never forget that as we become preoccupied with our domestic issues. The use of modern technology such as nuclear weapons, chemical and biological agents literally could destroy the planet. Don't forget, we're the last superpower. And with this comes an enormous responsibility to people all over the world who are not as fortunate as we are. As the world's last superpower, our great country should not only have a balanced budget, it should be debt-free, and it should have a significant financial surplus to pay for emergencies, as odd as that must sound to you. Some people are saying, why would you want a surplus? Well, it makes sense for Chrysler to have a $7.5 billion surplus. We clearly understand why companies should have surpluses. We understand why people should have money in the bank. So how can we rationalize, as the world's last superpower, being $4.8 trillion in debt with no plan at all to balance the budget, pay our debt, or create a surplus? If you're broke, you can't help other people. That sums up everything I've said. We've got to stop fantasizing, and we do a lot of that in our country. The whole world depends on us to conduct our affairs in a responsible way. All you've got to do is look at the left-hand column of the New York Times front page this morning. They've all gotten together to talk about money. The Germans are basically saying that Washington's unwillingness to further trim our budget deficits are not acceptable. That's from Germany. Japan is saying that the dollar problem was made in America and must be fixed here. This is on the 50th anniversary of World War II. And finally, the director of the International Monetary Fund will not relent in his criticisms of American financial policy. We've got to stay financially strong. The best example I can give you of our fantasy land that we live in is the 1993 Clinton economic plan. Follow me through here. It gave us one of the largest tax increases in history, but it never balanced the budget ever. And the national debt skyrockets as we enter the first three decades of the 21st century to the point that there is a one-year increase in the debt in the year 2030. This is just one year. It's forecasted to be $4.1 trillion. That's just the increase in the debt in one year. And that was the economic plan that would ensure our future. And finally, and as Paul Harvey would say, here's the rest of the story. Only in America, a few months later, would you have both parties rushing to the American people after trying to control the debt and raising taxes and failing to do it, coming back saying, we're going to offer you tax cuts, and this is nothing more than free candy to entice your vote in the 1996 election. It has nothing to do with reality. In plain Texas talk, either the 1993 tax increase didn't make any sense, or the current plans to decrease taxes don't make any sense, and I would love to hear anybody rationalize how both could possibly make sense. One of our problems is our government is run like a magician's act. It is filled with illusions. Appearances, images, spend control, and polls are everything. Producing real results for the owners of the country, our people, carries a low priority. It's how does it look? How did it spin? Could you get the story where you wanted it the way you wanted it? You live with that day in and day out. I hope you'll clean it up. As we approach the 21st century, our country faces a number of problems that must be dealt with now. Our financial problems are so large they require immediate attention. On examination, the financial numbers leap at you like a flashing red light from an instrument panel, warning that we only have a narrow window of opportunity to deal with these money problems, or they will surge out of control and literally destroy our country. In Churchill's words, we need action this day. Our major financial problems include, number one, the debt and the deficit. We're now spending 15 times as much a year to run this great country as we did when JFK was president. I ask you, are we 15 times better off? I suggest to you, for that amount of money, we should have utopia. We don't. Spending a lot of money didn't produce results for the American people. The national debt is now $4.8 trillion. The Office of Management and Budget, this is the president's staff, forecast the increase in the debt in just one year to rise to over $4 trillion. One year increase in the debt in the year 2030. Let's go to Social Security. In 1950, we had 16 people working for everybody receiving Social Security payments. By 1990, that number had dropped to 3 people at work for every retired person receiving payments. In the year 2030, we will only have 2 people at work for every retired person receiving benefits. Obviously, we need a Social Security trust fund. Congress created one and dramatically increased Social Security taxes on workers and their companies. Our national leaders are on television almost every night promising that they will protect the Social Security trust fund. Here are the facts. It doesn't exist. How can you protect something that doesn't exist? Congress has already spent the money on other projects in a less pretend effort to artificially report a smaller deficit to the American people every year. We should have $500 billion accumulated in this Social Security trust fund. All we have is a sheet of paper. You say, well, don't worry about it. Congress doesn't even pay the interest on the note. They just roll the interest forward. In contrast, $500 billion in a pension fund properly managed over a 30-year period and earning 8% would grow to $5 trillion. That's the way a pension fund should be handled. Since the fund doesn't exist, the 2 people at work for each retired person in the year 2030 are going to have to pay a terrible price for this mishandling of the Social Security Trust Fund. For example, the one-year deficit in the Social Security Trust Fund is forecasted to be $5.5 trillion in the year 2050. Now see, when you can see all these indicators now, we need to fix it now. Ignore the propaganda coming out of Washington. Social Security will not continue as we know it because of the magnitude of this problem. But in the meantime, we play less pretend to protect a non-existent trust fund and force our children and grandchildren to carry what will be an unconscionable tax burden. If you want to understand our country's problems, I can boil my advice down to you into 3 words. Follow the money. That's what I've been doing. Let's go to Medicare. When Medicare was created in 1965, it was forecasted to grow to $9 billion in the year 1990. The amount spent in 1990 was $106 billion. Our forecast was wrong by a factor of 12. Let's go to the Medicare Trust Fund. It is now forecasted to be bankrupt in the year 2002. The government forecasts the annual cost of Medicare and Medicaid will grow to $3.9 trillion in the year 2030 because of our huge retired population. and more than twice the amount we spend to run our entire country today. I mean, you don't need a PhD in economics to see what's coming here, folks. Let's go to Medicaid. Medicaid was forecasted when it was started that it would cost $1 billion in 1990. The actual amount spent was $91.3 billion. The forecast was off by a factor of 91. I think we need some new forecasters. So what can we learn from Medicare and Medicaid? Ignore what they're saying in words and follow the money. Taxpayer guarantees, never forget them. In addition, the American taxpayers have guaranteed $17 trillion to protect everything from banks, savings and loans, private pension funds, government pension funds, small investors in Wall Street, home mortgages, student loans, and other programs. If we allow our economy to deteriorate, see, all of this fits together. If you allow the economy to deteriorate, the odds that these guarantees will come due go straight up. That is the overwhelming argument I can make to you today, that we must not allow our economy to continue to deteriorate. Just one little example. Our federal pension funds are unfunded, and the obligation today is $1.4 trillion. This is not small numbers we're talking about. So as you think of the pension funds, go past the talk and follow the money. Short-term debt. Over 70% of our $4.8 trillion has been financed short-term, and we've recently been driving that number even higher than 70% to reduce the deficit with lower interest payments. This is a ticking bomb as interest rates go up. Each 1% at our current debt that interest rates increase will increase our debt by $34 billion a year. Now, if you listen to what all our international competitors are saying, we're sitting in a situation where the interest rate payments are liable to go up. For further evidence of our financial problems, go to page 25 of President Clinton's 1995 budget. And please listen to this. These are the president's numbers. He forecasts that the next generation to be born will pay an 82% tax rate. The American dream just died right there. The number went up to 84% in 1 year, so this year they didn't print it. If you still need more proof, go to the famous Alice Rivlin memo, written in October 94, just before the election, where she points out that the 1 year increase in the national debt in the year 2020 will be $1.5 trillion. That's the size of our budget. And then force yourself to look out to the year 2030, where the forecast is the 1 year increase in the national debt will be $4.1 trillion. So much for the Clinton economic plan and the promise to balance the budget. Maybe the best way to explain the magnitude of this problem to plain folks, and that's my constant challenge, is to tell them if you want to pay this debt, every family in the country's got to write a $72,000 check. They can't do that. That's too much debt. Next, in my never-ending search on how to explain this to people, let's just round up all of the U.S. currency and put it in one place. Every dollar bill, every $5 bill, every penny, nickel, and dime, and put it in one place. All of the currency in existence does not equal $4.8 trillion. Isn't that enough of an argument to convince the American people that the debt is too large? Believe it or not, we don't have $4.8 trillion in currency. So when it comes to all of this, just follow the money. Let's go to the trade deficit. We've got another ticking bomb in the trade deficit. We have the largest trade deficit in the history of the world. Now, you don't hear that. All you hear is the glory of free trade. Largest trade deficit in the history of the world. It was $165 billion in 94. It's projected to be $200 billion in 1995. In plain talk, last year we had $165 billion leave the country, and this year we're going to have about $200 billion go out of the U.S., because of our one-sided trade agreements. The trade deficit is like cancer. We're willing to treat colds, we're willing to treat minor problems, but we don't want to deal with the cancer. Each $1 billion in the trade deficit costs 20,000 jobs a year. The 220,000 jobs in the United States, the $200 billion trade deficit will cost us 4 million jobs. Just follow the money. Now let's go to NAFTA as a specific example. It was completely misrepresented to the American people. Mexico was presented as a role model for democracy and economic development. Go back during the NAFTA speech. President Salinas was presented to the American people as George Washington II. The abuse of most of the people in Mexico by the Mexican elite was carefully covered up and ignored, even though it is as plain as the nose on your face if you go to Mexico. and see how they forced the Mexican workers to live. I want to make it very clear that I have enormous respect and affection for the people of Mexico. They are excellent people and excellent workers. I do not respect the way the people that control that country treat the Mexican worker. The Mexican economy and government were presented to the American people still as strong and stable and role models to the world as recently as the economic summit in Miami after the 94 elections and just a few days before the peso collapsed. The last big event, everybody was heralding it as a big success. Our White House, now keep in mind, to get NAFTA through, the Mexicans spent $50 million with lobbyists. That was in our major papers. Now the White House is participating in a $52 billion peso bailout, which our major newspapers have accurately described as a bailout for the elite in our financial community around the world and the wealthy people in Mexico. If you haven't read those stories, get them and read them. Keep in mind, $50 million for lobbying, $52 billion to bail out the peso, that's 1,000 to 1. Think about it. The cruelest part of the tragedy, and the one we should all focus on, is that at least 80 million wonderful, good, decent people in Mexico have been devastated by these events. They're losing their homes and everything else they've ever bought on credit as interest rates soar to over 100%. And some of these were conditions we imposed on Mexico as a condition for getting the bailout. The bailout didn't help the Mexican people. It bailed out the guys in Wall Street. They took the money and did not go back into Mexico, believe me. The money they took was in a currency stabilization fund. It had been invested in yen and Deutschmarks, two good currencies. We pulled it out, started investing the peso, and the dollar fall has gone on. See, people don't tie things together. When did the dollar start falling? Why? The stabilization fund has been dedicated to the peso, not the dollar. That's what it's supposed to be for. Data available from the Mexican government will tell you the whole story. In 1989, the typical Mexican worker made a little over $9 a day, 1989. Now keep in mind, now we have George Washington II in office. Things are getting better, 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 better. And in 1994, before the peso crashed, that $9 a day had dropped to $3.13 a day. But nobody ever focused on that. Folks, people who don't buy make anything can't buy anything. You heard all these stories about Walmart and everybody going down there, and then in fine print they said they'd had to close them or they'd close most of the cash registers, et cetera, et cetera. People who don't make anything can't buy anything. After the peso devaluation, the $3.13 a day became $1.88 a day. Typical Mexican family now cannot afford to even buy food, much less products made in the USA. The money used to stabilize the peso accomplished little or nothing except to protect the investors at taxpayer expense. The best single piece on this whole subject was written by A.M. Rosenthal in the New York Times on April 5, 1995. The title is a pretty blunt one. The U.S. lied about Mexico's finances. I think it's not asking too much to have our people that we send up here as our elected servants tell us the truth, particularly on things as simple and direct as numbers. And now let's look at the NAFTA trade deficit alone. The trade deficit for 1995, now keep in mind this is going to be the savior of the world if we got NAFTA through, is forecasted for 1995 to be $20 billion. That's just what we need is another growing trade deficit. Follow the money. And now let's go to the U.S. dollar. For years, the term sound as a dollar was a trademark of the stability and strength of our currency. We just take for granted that the dollar will always be the world's reserve currency. We cannot assume this. We have to earn it. A $1931 bill is worth about 10 cents today. In 1953, $1 would buy 360 Japanese yen. Today, it buys 83. That's a 77% drop. Middle Eastern oil countries use the dollar as the currency reserve. They're now openly expressing concern about the stability of the dollar. If they shift to another currency, the fluctuating cost of oil in this country can have a dramatic and adverse effect on our people and our economy. We must keep the dollar strong and stable in order for it to continue as the world's reserve currency. The weakness of the dollar is directly tied to our irresponsible runaway debt and mismanagement of our government. If you question that, read the New York Times left-hand column today. Some interesting points were made in a book that was printed in 1992. By the year 2000, foreigners will own approximately 20% of the U.S. gross national product. foreign firms could account for 25% of U.S. manufacturing production and 45% of the U.S. banking sector. Guess who wrote the book? Alice Rivlin. The title of the book is Reviving the American Dream. She's a senior person on President Clinton's staff. I urge him to listen to her. If you look at the numbers we've discussed today, why would we expect the world to have confidence in the dollar? Again, follow the numbers. Jobs. The magic of America is the fact that millions of people have had a good job that will allow them to support their families and have the world's highest standard of living. We can only balance our budget and pay our debt if we have a growing, expanding job base. We can only have this if millions of Americans are working at good paying jobs. Since 1980, the standard of living has significantly dropped for 4 out of 5 working Americans. 2 million U.S. manufacturing jobs were moved to Asia alone. The people who had these jobs were making $440 a week. If they have a job at all today, they're making $270 a week. And I don't have to tell you the value of the dollar has gone down during that period. So they're making less dollars, and what they're getting is worth less money. On the other hand, our Congress gets a cost of living adjustment. Every time the dollar gets cheaper, they make more money. Helps you understand why there's no discipline on spending. But the people in this country do not. Never forget that millions of people who work in good-paying jobs are the heart of our tax base and the key to our being able to balance our budget and pay the $4.8 trillion. So if you want to come up with a plan to balance the budget and pay the debt, you want to see a growing, expanding job base. And in this case, my summary is follow the job base. You can't tax people who aren't making money. The fact that both parents have to work in many homes now is a testimonial to the problem. All the studies show that most of the mothers would rather not be working. We're also moving our manufacturing base offshore. The net effect of this is to take the highest paid working jobs in America. Everybody says, don't worry, Ross, we're going to train everybody for these jobs of tomorrow, but nobody knows what they are. Number two, please never forget you have 65 million people in our workforce with high school diplomas or less. Not everybody is a rocket scientist, including myself. And you have to understand that just good, honest work cannot all be transported to the cheapest labor in the world if we're to keep a strong economy. Now then, let's come down to the things I think you want to talk about. Millions of independent voters in 1994 swept the Republicans into power in the House and the Senate. Their mood was, give the Republicans a chance. The percentage of voters who have confidence in our government has dropped dramatically. In 1964, 76% of all voters had confidence the way Washington operated. That number dropped to 19% in late 1994. How are our political parties distributed? 29% of the voters now say they're Democrats, 30% say they're Republicans, and, hold on to your hats, folks, 37% say they're independent voters. That is the strongest possible numerical signal I can give you of voter concern about what's happening in Washington. Interesting, the number of voters who claim they're not affiliated with either party exceeds the number of people who claim to be either Democrats or Republicans. And now this brings us to a third political party. 57% of the American voters now say they want a third political party, and the number goes up every time they take a new poll. 45% of Republicans say they want a third party. That's interesting. 45% of the Republicans. 48% of the Democrats want a third party. 65% of the independents want a third party. The problem is lack of trust. I'm running out of time, and so I'll handle all the rest of this in the Q&A. But let me close with these statements. To those who have heard this speech and who are deeply concerned about whether or not we can deal with and solve the problems that face our country, I leave you with Thomas Jefferson's words. Here they are. My confidence in my countrymen leaves me without much fear for the future. And I'm sure we all agree with that. Our challenge is to make sure that every citizen is fully informed and cast an informed vote. And finally, these lines summarize everything I've said today. The budget should be balanced. The treasury should be refilled. Public debt should be reduced. The arrogance of public officials should be controlled. These are not my words. Cicero spoke these words 2,000 years ago. History does repeat itself. Thank you very much. I'll take your questions. Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Given the fact that so many voters are disenchanted with their own parties, We have a whole flock of questions to ask. A very simple question. Do you plan to run for president again?
We will only do what is in the long-term best interest of our country. And in the meantime, we will have to endure all of the illusory statements that are made. For example, the theory that I put Bill Clinton into office has got to be one of the least accurate theories in the world. Let's go back to the campaign. I couldn't do business because everybody in the White House was saying, for heaven's sakes, Perot, don't drop out or Clinton will win by a landslide. Then I was getting the calls from Little Rock saying, for heaven's sake, drop out so that Clinton can win by a landslide. These guys spend a fortune on pollsters. Surely some of them knew what they were doing. Then let's go to the exit. You know, if let's go to the Joe Friday mode instead of the current myth that you'll hear being spouted over the next month. Now let's go to the exit polls from Election Day that showed that if everybody who had wanted to vote for me had voted for me, I would have won, but they had been convinced by the propaganda that I couldn't win and that they shouldn't waste their vote. Those are the hard facts, if facts matter. So we will wait. I want to give the Republicans and Democrats a chance to do the job. The part I didn't get to cover covers that. Maybe I'll get to cover it in the other questions. We want them to stand and deliver. We don't have any personal goals. We want to see our children. I was in Des Moines, Iowa last Friday night with the Future Farmers of America. I wish you could have all been with me. They were so good and so wholesome and so nice and so fine. And you look at them and you say, whatever it takes, we've got to leave them with the opportunity where somebody from out in the middle of nowhere can have a dream, pursue that dream, and change the world. Now, that's the history of what's happened in this country. And that's what drives us. We'll be very, very careful. We want the Republicans and Democrats right now. I guess my advice to the Republicans is you've gotten a good part of your contract with America through the House. There are parts of it that haven't gone through that even don't get brought up. And here are some that we feel very strongly have got to be dealt with. And let me see if I can find it here. I had to drop out. But it really boils down to the fact that you don't have a balanced budget amendment. That fell apart. You haven't come up with a plan to get rid of the foreign lobbyists. That fell apart. And you don't have campaign finance reform. And I detailed the need for campaign finance reform, which maybe I can work in the next 25 minutes. All these things they need to get busy on, and then you'll see the independent voters surging to the party that is serving the people. Let's give them time to do that.
A whole passel of questions here growing out of the tragic bombing in Oklahoma City and the sort of copycat tragedies that seem to be cropping up. What is your opinion of these militia groups, those paramilitary organizations that propose armed opposition to government? Should they be curbed somehow, and if so, how?
First, I don't know anything about them except what I read. My mental picture of these folks was that these are folks that like to run around in the woods in uniforms on the weekends, and I couldn't quite figure out what the appeal was, but I thought, well, if that's their hobby, that's their right. Now, the folks who, this thing in Oklahoma City is a tragedy, and when you think about those little children that are still trapped in, you know, their bodies in the buildings and whatever, you just wouldn't believe that anything like that could ever happen in our country, but it has. And swift, sure justice is the most important thing we can do. And we don't need an O.J. trial. Now, everybody that's got a TV camera is going to want to be in the courtroom, drag it on for 8 months, go through 6 juries, exhaust a judge, and if we have a female prosecutor, have her made over 8 times. Nothing that has to do anything with justice, with all the defense lawyers being out on TV every night, strutting their stuff, and running effectively an ad for their next clients. That's a tragedy too, folks. These folks need to be tried, sentenced, and executed pretty fast, and that kind of clears your head. Let me say this. That worked in the old West. It'll work today. Right now, instead, we build the glamour slammer. Let me just give you an example. Here's the way we treat prisoners. Just built a brand-new $53 million prison in San Francisco. It's got skylights They call them heliostats. They're controlled by computers so that you get the optimum light. You've got a $103,000 plaza, but the biggest uproar came, they bought a couch for $22,000 to put in the prison. It has a $600,000 art budget, and on and on and on and on. We're all fouled up in our thinking on how to deal with crime. I hope we'll get our heads straight on this one. I don't know of any way to stop the nuts, and the saddest thing of all is the slowest old boy in the world knows that you can take fertilizer and diesel fuel and blow something up now. Most people didn't know that. That is known by... But the good news is... The bad news is, I guess, these guys that did this seem to be slower than Forrest Gump. Now, events like this attract other nuts. Yeah, the letter bomber's back. And we need to find them, execute them, and just make it clear you don't do that in our society. That's my recommendation. In the meantime, please remember the families and the children in your prayers.
What effect, if any, does the anti-government rhetoric on many talk shows, radio talk shows and TV, have on haters out there in the heartland?
I've never listened to shows like that. I work all day, and most of these folks apparently, if there are shows that really preach hate, I've never heard them, and I think since I have no firsthand knowledge of them. But I said all during the campaign, if anybody out there hates other people, I don't want your vote. You can't have a great country where people hate one another. And hate should be something we teach children from infancy. You can either fill your heart with love or you can fill it with hate or whatever you want to, but it's so important that people fill their hearts with love for one another. Let's go back to what I call the hardcore stuff, the stuff that's got to be cleaned up. I mean, we're off now on a tragic event, but I don't want to spend my time on it. A lot of people say, Ross, do you think we have bad people in Washington? No, we have good people in Washington, but they're trapped inside a bad system. Now, for example, the 1994 political campaigns at the federal level cost $600 million. If you throw in the state and local ones, it was over $1 billion. Most of that had to be spent on television. Most of that television was mindless little one-minute ads, with Willie Horton kind of being at the outer edge of probably something that everybody was excited about. The average senator must raise $12,800 a week during his or her six-year term to get a total of $4 million to run. House member has to raise $5,800 a week. They need a total of $600,000 to run. A challenger can't even get in the ring with those huge sums. One of our 1996 presidential candidates summed up, and he says, the best friend you can have in American politics is plenty of money. Now, money drives the system, and until we correct that, we're going to have a problem. We've got 8 announced candidates for the Republican primaries, 1 to come, that's 9. The papers tell us they'll have to have $40 million apiece, right? That's $360 million. Folks, there's just a finite amount of money out there. And you're going to split it 9 ways, and in order to get it, let's not be naive, you're going to have to make some strong commitments that have nothing to do with the people in the best interest of this country. Now, let's look at how it works. You say, well, don't these donors, aren't they just ideologically inspired to give this money? Come on, give me a break. When the Democrats won the House, the Senate, and the White House in 92, all those folks that supported Republicans for years flooded the Democrats with money. They couldn't breathe, they got so much money. President Clinton raced out to the West Coast, had a $25,000 to $100,000, I don't know how you varied that, fundraiser in California. Now then, let's go to 94. Republicans came in power. Guess what? The Republicans had a dinner and 4,000 people attended and contributed $11 million. But wait a minute, it was a $1,000 ticket dinner. That's $4 million. 7,000 people sent money and didn't even get a hot meal, and they gave $7 million. And this had nothing to do with anything except getting back in the door with the folks in power. What do the donors want? They want their special interests protected, they want access to power, and they want to control the system. Our political system must belong to the people, not a handful of wealthy donors. And again, I stick with my 3 words, follow the money, and you'll understand what's wrong with that part of the system. Excuse me, but I had to get that out.
Okay. Well, we have a number of questions about how would you recommend that this country get out of debt and balance its budget, and specifically, what do you think of the flat tax versus a national sales tax as a substitute for the income tax we now have.
The two best minds in the Congress, unfortunately, one is a Democrat and one is Republican, are Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia and Senator Pete Domenici from New Mexico. They have produced a plan to balance the budget in the past. They're working on a new one now. My suggestion would be that we go to a bipartisan plan. And believe me, these two people have the knowledge and they have the staffs to put down a real plan, not some mirage, and deal with the problem. That's a logical, orderly way to do it. If people in now, those two have the moral courage to do it. If Congress doesn't want to do it, maybe you've got to create a commission to put together a plan. But that commission is going to have to go sell the plan to the American people, because everybody running for office is scared to death to look you in the eye and say, I've got to take the free candy away from you. We're at that point. Second thing, your second question was the flat tax.
Flat tax.
Interesting concept. I said all during 92, we need a new tax system. It should be paperless. It's got to be fair, et cetera, et cetera. But when you come up with a new tax system, there is great news here. You can computer model that tax system and dramatically reduce the surprises that come from it. I would hold back on my judgment on any flat tax system or value-added tax or other plan going through Congress until these extensive computer models are run and we find out all these ugly little surprises nobody thought about, modified and improved. See, you wouldn't think of building an airplane and not putting it in a wind tunnel, right? But in Congress, you get 100 people in a room, put together a health care plan, get the word that you can't afford it, and try to sell it to the American people for 2 years, and then finally have to give up the papers that said we never could have paid for it anyhow. See, if my best friend in the world was a blacksmith, I wouldn't let him build my airplane. I hope I've made my point.
Well, doesn't a flat tax favor the wealthy at the expense of the lower income groups?
As I've said a million times, I wish they would just tax the wealthy at 100%. Now, I would be glad to live in a tent in poverty to get the message over, and the press won't focus on this. If you confiscate all the wealth of the Forbes 400, you take their dogs, their cats, their yachts, every penny they've got. Now they're just dead broke on the street saying, we'll work for food. You can't balance the budget 1 year. Now I'm back to what I preach and preach and preach, and hey, you know, it's hard to get it over, is that millions of people working at good-paying jobs are our tax base. That's where the tax base is. And we love to throw out what I call gorilla dust. When gorillas fight, they throw dust in the air to distract the other gorilla. You know, this is for the wealthy. Anything you don't want. You know, if you form a third party, that puts Clinton back in power. Well, is that a fact or fiction? If someone will just say it, that's news, and everybody runs out and prints it without questioning it. I suggest that we ought to send thinking man's filters to every person in the press and say, after you hear all this stuff, and particularly when they hand it to you out of the White House war room, walk around the block two or three times and say, is there even a grain of truth to it?
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.